Thank God it's Free Range. You are listening to Free Range Radio Friday with your host, Michael Elves. Pour yourself a beverage and turn up the volume, because here on 101.5 UMFM, the weekend starts now.
UMFM. This is Thank God It's Free Range, the Friday edition of Free Range Radio. I'm Michael Elves, and kicking things off tonight, that is new Merge artist Swearin' with Oil and Water from Fallen to the Sun. That's coming out very shortly. Band leader Allison Crutchfield, if the last name rings a bell, that is because her sister Katie Crutchfield performs under the name Waxahachie. Allison has toured as part of the Waxahachie band, but this is her own vehicle, and great stuff. Exciting new music from them. We got lots of exciting new music. It's a little different tonight. We are online only, doing this as a podcast, because Bison Women's Hockey celebrate the banner raising for their championship season from last year, and so Thank God It's Free Range is preempted. But I do have a couple of sort of time-sensitive things. I'm going to be talking to Christopher Sams, a.k.a. C. Sams, whose album release, Synthetic Properties, is tonight at Grey Owl Coffee on Main Street. He's going to be doing a listening party and DJ set, and vinyl copies of the album as well as downloads will be available for purchase. I'll also talk to jazz drummer Ernesto Cervini. His outfit Turboprop releases its album Abundance on Anzik Records today, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. In the interim, this is a brand new track from Slow Spirit. They have an album coming out called Idol. This is Nobody Knows here on 101.5 UMFM.
Nobody knows my sorrow. A common cry from the heart. I didn't know how
getting its debut this Friday at Grey Owl Coffee. Synthetic Properties, the new record from C. Sams, a.k.a. Christopher Sams, old guest on Thank God It's Free Range, and he's back. How are you doing, Christopher?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing good. You've recorded under several different kind of monikers. What led to just going as C. Sams?
I think I was just ready to do the old solo project thing, just as close to as close as I can get to just a personal thing.
Is that this music that you're making is kind of the most personal music you've made, or just like it was time for you to kind of take on the personal moniker?
It's probably the least collaborative project I've done.
Right.
As far as the content of the music goes, it's no more personal than I guess On Animals was.
Right. Now, I mean, there's the Uniter kind of like review mentions vaporwave and synth pop. Did you kind of go into this with like kind of a specific sound or like idea in mind musically?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to sort of use this project as a way to pay homage to my favorite 80s synth acts. The vaporwave thing is unintentional, I would say, but I welcome it, as it's a pretty fun genre that is based I think, pretty heavily in a lot of 80s synth pop. But I wanted to aim for 80s synth pop and minimal wave artists that have sort of been influencing me along the way.
Which artists or which records in particular kind of first kind of caught your attention within this sound?
I would say at first, I mean, definitely New Order and Kraftwerk. Those were definitely gateway artists into this whole minimal wave synth pop sound, as well as Depeche Mode, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. But then I started getting into some of these other artists that didn't really make it very big in the 80s. A lot of the artists that would record in their bedrooms or in their living rooms, artists like Absolute Body Control, Linear Movement, Oppenheimer Analysis, those kinds of groups.
So with groups like that, how did you kind of land upon them? I mean, if the, you know, like you said, these weren't the ones that everyone knows about. How did you kind of start kind of burrowing deeper into this genre?
Recently, there have been a few record labels that have taken it upon themselves to sort of reissue these albums that have only come out on tape. They've started putting them out on vinyl. Some of these record labels are, one of them is called Minimal Waves, fittingly enough. There are other ones like Dark Entries or Medical Records.
So is there a particular thing about the sound that you gravitate towards too, or is it like texture or kind of like a, like an all encompassing thing?
I think a lot of the sounds, I've always been drawn to the sound, whether or not I knew where to look to find it. And that's what sort of led me to bands like New Order and Kraftwerk. But I think it's something that's sort of based in nostalgia. It's the TV shows and the commercials that I grew up with were using these sounds. And once I found artists and music that use these sounds, I sort of gravitated towards that. And it became something that I wanted to explore more myself and produce.
It's interesting you mentioned like TV shows. I came across a compilation of Mike Post composed music for TV themes and stuff, and yeah, like this definitely fits in same line with that. As far as the like gear that you used on this record, I think it's like a pretty like extensive list. Was there any stuff that you hadn't used before as a musician? Like, did you kind of have to learn any new instruments or tech?
Well, I've actually been working on the album for a few years, so I've played with synthesizers for about a decade or so now, but this sort of forced me to really learn how to control the parameters, and if I had a sound in mind, I had to teach myself sort of how to create that exact sound just through twisting knobs or adjusting levels. So that One of the synthesizers that I found it really easy to learn on was the Roland SH-101. The way they just have the board laid out is really intuitive, and so in making this album, I sort of really got to know that one.
Mm-hmm. Is there like a kind of situation where like you have an idea in your mind or you know a sound in your head, and you have to kind of like figure out which instrument, which you know tech will get you there and achieve that sound? Like, do you kind of have to like fiddle around with like, oh no, this isn't quite mirroring what I hear, and kind of try it on each?
Yeah, that's definitely a situation that I found myself in a few times. One thing that I learned about synthesizers, and this is definitely not something I knew before, because I used to basically purchase synthesizers based on their preset sounds. But what I learned in creating this album is that you can do a lot with one synthesizer. And for the most part, depending on the make and model, you can, if you know how to adjust the parameters, you can pretty much get whatever you want on any synth. But yeah, I found myself definitely falling back on the SH-101 whenever I would try to achieve something on another one. It just... it felt more natural working with the Roland product.
Right. You mentioned that you'd been kind of working on this for a couple of years. Is that, you know, what accounts for that time, let's say? Like, are you kind of writing songs during that time, or are you kind of experimenting with kind of how to achieve your vision, or is it like kind of the whole encompassing process? I'm just curious kind of like what goes into a couple of years of working on a record like this.
Well, I guess when I started off, I didn't really know where I was going with it. I had a space set up where I would go and fiddle with synthesizers, and sometimes I would record, sometimes I wouldn't. And then sort of sneaking those moments in between, you know, life stuff like working and getting together with friends and family. So I wasn't really in a rush to create something, but I think what sort of expedited it was there's this thing called Jamuary that I participate in. I've participated in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. kind of like Inktober, where every day you draw something and you post it to Instagram. Whereas Jamuary is you create a little song, melody, and whatever ends up coming out of that, you sort of post it on social media. And so from that, I basically started 62 different songs, so I figured I should probably finish some of them. And
you said 62?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I was like, did I hear that right?
Yeah. So every day in January, I started a new song.
So you obviously had to eliminate 50 of those, or 62, to get down to 12 songs that are on the record. What mm-hmm. is like the winnowing process like for you?
Well, luckily, I decided which ones I would use from January 2017, and I sort of locked it all in before I got to January 2018. So I really just had the 31 to whittle down from. So it wasn't too hard to whittle down from there. And then there were a few originals from a couple of years prior that I knew that I wanted to include. So I sort of, I guess, looked at which ones got the best response on social media, which was a nice little tool, but also there were a few that I was just more proud of than others. So, and I knew that I could always come back to them if I ever put out another album, which, I mean, I have enough material to, so it's likely, but I'm not sure when or how.
So putting things out on social media and kind of gleaning responses, is that like a good thing as an artist to kind of get feedback like that, or can that kind of like come in the way of like your own take on your material? Or
yeah, I think that's a good question. I've always been surprised that, like, in all the other bands and stuff that I've been in, I've always been surprised to find out which songs people gravitate towards. It's usually the ones that, you know, I think is just like, you know, it's a fine song, but certainly not my favorite. But so I think it can be an interesting tool, but I think it is important to not rely too heavily on that, and still just make sure you're doing what you set out to do and you're staying true to your vision.
So speaking of your vision, like the songs that you ended up with on Synthetic Properties, do you feel that there's like kind of like a through line or kind of like linkage amongst them, or like it was just like kind of the ones you were most happy with putting out as a record?
Well, it's half the songs are instrumental, so in terms of what songs are about, I guess there isn't a clear linkage there. It's sort of the songs that I felt were some of my favorites, but also songs that I found that those 12 songs sort of balanced each other out as a full piece of music in terms of track 1 through to track 12. Mm. It would be pretty tempting to just choose all the most exciting or accessible songs and put those all out, but I believe in a flow of an album, and that it's good to release a single, and there are definitely standout tracks, but I think it's important to consider how the entire album feels.
And you're releasing this on vinyl, so you obviously had to give consideration to like side A, side B, and how that flows as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a tricky piece of the puzzle to get the right flow, to be happy with which tracks come after the other tracks, but also make it so that it's sort of an even balance in terms of duration.
Right, because it has
side.
To fit.
Yeah.
And how, like, as I understand it, there's limited kind of pressing plant opportunities. Like, did you have to wait an extensive period of time to get this pressed to vinyl, or?
Well, when I heard how much time it would take, it was actually less time than I thought that it would take. I think it was a couple months. I can't remember now. It's been so long. but when I was actually waiting for the record to be pressed, it definitely felt longer than it sounded. But I think at that point I was just anxious to get these songs out into the world.
Sure enough. Well, speaking of getting them out of the world, Friday at Grail Coffee, 272 Main Street, you're having a listening party and DJ set. And so as you posted in the Facebook page about this, you're going to be playing some of the records that kind of inspired you in between. Excuse me. Sorry. sorry. Sneezing going on. You're going to be playing records in between that kind of inspired the creation of this record. I think that's a really interesting idea to kind of like show people kind of like where this fits within the context of like the stuff that you're into.
Yeah. And, I sort of want to share my inspirations, and, I think, there is a temptation to sort of keep that private or keep that hidden, but, I'm not really, I guess, making any, claims that I'm the first person to make something that sounds like this. So I figure why not share some of the groups and some of the bands that took me so long to find, and maybe people who like this type of music, they can sort of discover some new bands as well as checking out my new album.
And so 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. you'll be playing it kind of like front to back at those two times?
Right. Yeah.
Right. And the album obviously will be available for purchase there. Before we go, I want to get you to pick a track off the record that we can play for listeners to kind of give them a little preview here.
Okay.
And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about the song, I'd love to hear that.
Sure. I think I'll go with the track called Hex, just because I have been focusing more on the tracks with lyrics. I'll pick an instrumental one. I'll go with this one's actually one of the favorites off the album for me, partially due to the fact that the instrumentals are generally my favorites, just because I don't always love hearing the sound of my own voice. But but for this one, this was one that came out of a Jamuray session, and I had a start to it, and I really liked the starting of it, but then I felt a ton of pressure to create a middle and an end to it. So I worked hard on this one, and I'm very happy with the way it turned out. So, it ended up being one of my favorites.
Perfect. Well, we'll give that one a listen. Christopher, thanks for taking some time, and best of luck with the album launch.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, he is one of the busiest figures in the Canadian jazz scene with several releases with him on it or under his name. And the most recent from Ernesto Cervini's Turboprop. He joins us by phone. How are you doing, man?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So I know that you were on the tour with Karin Davidson.
Yes.
We had them on the show a little while ago. How was that tour?
It was really fun. It was a really, really great concept because it's the band is the Karin Davidson Nine, and it's usually seven horns and then bass and drums. And what they decided to do is, because traveling across Canada with nine people can be rather expensive.
Okay.
And yeah, cumbersome, exactly. So it was five of us. It was myself and the bass player, and then William and Tara, which is like alto saxophone and trombone. And then the lead trumpet player, and then everyone else in the band we picked up in the different provinces that we played in. So there was a Manitoba foursome that joined us, and then there was an Alberta foursome and a Saskatchewan foursome. And so it was a really great way to meet and interact and perform with these fantastic musicians that are living, you know, outside of our little bubble in Toronto. And something that, like, to be honest, I'd never played with any of those, that 12 people that we met and played with. And I feel like now that I have, the chance for more more collaboration is huge. So it was a real, like, community building tour on top of just being, you know, really fun to play that music a bunch.
Right. Did you find, you know, working with, like, a slate of new people each time, like, were you hearing the music fresh with each kind of grouping?
Yeah, people were bringing different things to it for sure. And it, I mean, it was interesting because usually when you go on tour, the music really, really grows and loosens up from the beginning of the tour to the end of the tour. And this one was kind of different because we were playing with, I mean, it wasn't different people every time, but there were a couple of the bands got to play the music twice. So even there was a big difference from the first gig to the second gig. But it didn't have the same kind of loosening up that a tour often brings, just because the personnel was changing. But as you said, because the personnel was changing, it was the music was kind of changing, and the way people approached it was different. And so again, it was a very unique experience.
Right. Now, that was with Tara Davidson and William Karn, mm-hmm. who are on Abundance, the new record. And as I understand it, kind of in the same way that the Murphy features like one of your tracks and some other members of the ensemble's compositions, likewise, this one features other people's within the group's compositions as well. Is that just like kind of part of this crew that you run with, that everyone's kind of sliding music back and forth, or is it like like an ethos that you all ascribe to, or what's the rationale behind all that?
I mean, for me personally, it was that, you know, the it's my band, but I wanted to find a way to make it feel like it was everyone's band. Because I'm in a collective trio called Myriad 3, and it's that band works really well because it's all of our band. So there is no band leader, there is no one person who's in charge, and everyone contributes music and everyone contributes everything. So I love the way that feels, and I wanted to have that same feeling in Turboprop, where, yes, it's my band, but I want it to feel like it's everyone's band. And everyone has a say, and everyone has, you know, can contribute as much or as little as they want. And so I thought that was one way to do it, is to invite everyone to write for the group. And not, I mean, I certainly didn't demand it, but I just said, if you want, I'd love to play one of your tunes in the band if you want. So if you want to do it, bring it in. If you don't, that's fine too. And over the first three albums, we've done something by everyone. Mm-hmm. And then I know for William and Tara in the Karn Davidson 9, their concept is that all the songs are written by them, but they're arranged by a ton of musicians across Canada. So they do some of the arranging, but then they farm out a lot of the arranging to other musicians. So on the new album, there's one of my arrangements. And it's a really cool concept.
You mentioned, a ton of musicians. You work with a ton of musicians as a publicist.
Yes.
And I'm curious, like, was that kind of an outgrowth of just being in the jazz community and touring across the country and connecting with jazz artists? Is that, like, you saw an opportunity with that? Or, like, you know, had you started this kind of before you started doing the networking on the performance side? Or
I mean, it all happened pretty organically. It was something that I had thought about doing for a while, just because I felt like there was a need mm-hmm. for, like, a specialized jazz publicist in at least in Ontario. And so I toyed with the idea for a long time, but, you know, like anything else, is like, yeah, I should do that sometime, and then just never did it. And then someone actually got in touch with me and hired me. Like, oh, I guess I'm doing it.
Mm.
So that was the kick in the pants that I needed. And then it just kind of grew from there. So it had very small, you know, it started small, and now it's one of the main things I do is run a publicity company, outside of obviously being a performing and touring musician. So, and the networking part, I mean, networking is such an essential part of jazz anyways, because, you know, the days of being in one band are kind of gone. You can't make a living playing in one band because there's not enough gigs. So you're constantly playing with all these different people and different situations and maybe even different styles. And so that was kind of always happening. And so that helped with the publicity company. And then that just grew with this last tour. And, you know, the more you tour around, you want to meet other musicians in other scenes, because that's part of the jazz community. That's how it grows and flourishes.
Right. I mean, you've been keeping yourself busy as a publicist with your own output as a performer. I mean, because you were mentioning the Myriad 3. I mean, Myriad 3 has a new album out.
Yeah.
You have your own album out. You know, you're on other people's albums. How do you kind of, like, switch focus or switch gears, you know, to kind of focus, like, concentrate on one or kind of make sure you're committed to one or the other, or giving each sort of fair shift?
Right. It's difficult. I will say that. I think the most difficult part is I have two young children. So
that makes anything difficult.
Yeah. They take about 90%, and then I have 10% left to spread amongst all these other things. It can be tricky. I mean, I'm a bit of a restless soul, so this kind of suits me perfectly. If I had one or two things, I would probably just get a little, I'd get restless, and I'd get, I don't know about bored, but I work best when I have lots of things on my plate. So, you know, the Myriad is always a focus, because it's a collective and the three of us have committed to it being kind of our main focus, musically. So we rehearse every week. Actually, the guys just left. We were rehearsing today. So that band is always kind of, it's always there. And then everything else, you know, it's always on my mind. So I'm always thinking about, oh, maybe I could do this for Turboprop next, or maybe I could do this for, you know, I'm in another band called Toontown. That's another kind of collective. We haven't recorded anything yet, but that's coming up. So I've been thinking a little bit about that. And I don't know, I just feel like it's fun to have a lot of things on the go, and switching gears musically, I don't want to say that it's not challenging, but it's just part of what you do as a drummer. You have to be able to just go with the flow of whatever you're playing at that moment and commit to that. So
as far as apportioning your own, you know, creative output, like your own songs, like, mm-hmm. do you determine, okay, this is a Myriad 3 number, this is a Turboprop number? Like, do you have a sense of, like, what belongs with each ensemble?
Yeah, it depends on, I think every situation is different, but sometimes I'll be writing something and in my head I can immediately hear, oh, that's going to be a Myriad thing, or that's going to be a Turboprop thing. And sometimes not. I have one song that I wrote that I thought was going to work with Myriad and never really did. And so now I'm going to try and come up with a Turboprop arrangement and see if that works, and maybe that won't. And sometimes maybe it's just not a good song. I don't know. You know, and it also depends on the need. Like, if I need to write a song for Myriad, then I'll set out doing that. If I'm just composing without necessarily having a goal in mind, then I'll write and see kind of what happens and see how it feels. And, you know, because writing for those bands is very different. For Myriad, it's a trio, so I can just bring in a lead sheet, and then we're going to work on it and beef it up and, make it into something with turboprop, it has to be pretty much arranged already for three horns and rhythm section. So even just bringing the music in is a different process.
So the material on the new one, you have two originals, both. First of all, the fact that they're kind of the album closer, that you put them last, is there like a rationale for that, or did it just kind of work sonically?
It was just a musical thing.
Okay.
It wasn't, I just thought it flowed the best that way. And to be honest, when I was doing it, I was looking at the songs without necessarily thinking about who the composers were. And then when I looked at it after, I thought, oh, the last two tunes are like, I'm leaving my originals until the end. And then I thought, well, what, you know, that's fine. It's good. It's like, it's not like we need to start with my tunes because it's my band. I try to make sure that all the decisions I make in music are based on music and not have it based on, well, I want the album to start with my song because it's my album.
Right.
It's, you know, it feels like it should always serve whatever serves the music best. And if that's what happens. So, and I kind of like the idea of ending with Song for Cito because it's a very triumphant kind of, I think, positive song. And so I thought it's nice to end on a positive note, you know?
Yeah, particularly because, I mean, the album's called Abundance, right? It's about gratitude and taking stock of that. Cito Gaston.
Yeah.
Did you, like, conceive of this as a tribute to him? Or did you, like, in the writing, did it become a tribute to him? How did, like, this come about?
It was right away. I wanted to write a song for Cito.
Okay.
I went to see the, you know, I grew up a Blue Jays fan.
Uh-huh.
And I was 10 years old when they won the first World Series. So they were pretty, you know, that's pretty memorable when you're a little kid. And so I wanted to write a song for him. And I wanted it to sound triumphant and happy and victorious. And so that's, yeah, that one was, some songs you write it and then you think about what it means after, and some songs you go in thinking, okay, I'm going to write, you know, like when I wrote Gramps, that was for my grandfather. I wrote that for him. That was the idea right away. And same with Song for Cito. Like I had a kind of an inspiration when I sat down to write.
You mentioned before about having young kids. I'm curious, as a touring musician, how that impacts, you know, your working life and how you juggle that with parenthood.
that's a great question. Don't ask my wife. it's really hard. I mean, I try not to tour too much because it really does have an impact on my family. And it was one thing before I had children. You know, then it's what, you know, you leave, and it was hard on my wife anyways to be alone, but nothing like now when I leave. And so I try and keep the tours to like about 10 days. The deal is 10 days, but sometimes they go to 11 or 12, but I try and keep them around 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to do too much. Again, because it's just really hard here at home, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to make them, make it too hard on them right now, because, you know, the kids are only so young for so long. And then I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. So, you know, once the younger one is in school, things will ease up a little bit and it'll become a little bit easier. But it is a real logistical challenge. And trying to find that balance between music and career and family. And, you know, there isn't a great track record for traveling musicians and keeping their families together. So it's something I'm definitely always aware of. And, you know, it creates a challenge. But I think it's important to travel around and play music. I think if you're going to be a musician, you need to perform. And you can only perform in your given city so often. So it's important to get out there and perform and bring the music across, whether it's going across Canada or over to Europe, and showing people over there that there's great music happening in Canada. I think it's really vital.
Have you either like accepted gigs or like declined gigs based on how it kind of worked out with like familial commitment and stuff? Have you played a festival because you could take your kids to it, or, you know, not played a gig because it just didn't line up with, you know,
I've definitely not played gigs because I'm going to be honest with you. I wouldn't tell someone like I'm saying no just because it's not convenient for my family. I'll just say, oh, I'm working, especially because it's a tough thing because people who don't have children don't totally understand. And so, and that's a decision I made to have a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've said, I try not to very often. And I mean, of course, if it was, a band where I was a vital part of the unit, then I wouldn't have that flexibility. But if it's something where it's a sideman thing and it's maybe a band that I'm just subbing in, then yeah, I'll look at the schedule, and if it seems like it's going to be too hard on my family and maybe not necessarily worth putting everyone out, then I'll say no. And to be honest, that's the new thing, because that certainly was not the case even a couple of years ago. It's hard to say no to gigs because you never know when the next one's going to come.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to say no and then suddenly you're not working for 3 months. You're going, I should have said yes to that one. But at the same time, you know, you just have to have faith that things will keep happening and you have to do what's best.
You mentioned the track record of like a touring musician and familial success isn't necessarily the highest. How have you kind of sorted out like a path towards success then? Have you, like, are there, you know, peers who are in the same sort of experiences as you and you've like, you know, asked them about it, or is there someone that you look at as like kind of an example or paragon?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a couple. I have an older sister who's a jazz musician, Amy Cervini. She lives in New York and she's a jazz singer. And so I talk to her about this stuff all the time because she's touring. She's in a group called Duchess. It's like a three-part vocal group.
Mm-hmm.
And they're touring around a bunch. And she has two children. And so I'm talking to her all the time. And my wife is talking to her all the time. We're always trying to figure out how this works. And then the bass player in Turboprop, Dan Loomis, he has two children. And he travels a lot. So, you know, and whenever we go on the road, we're roommates. So we're always discussing, you know, how you do this and what you do and how it works. And then one of my, one of the drummers that is the biggest influence on me and one of my favorite drummers that's alive right now is a drummer named Matt Wilson, who's based in New York. And he has four kids. Now, they're much older now, but he's been, you know, he's a great father, and actually he's a single father now because his wife passed away a couple of years ago. But he seems to manage, and his kids are great. And so, you know, it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be careful and you have to be judicious in what you just decide to do. I can say that this fall, I taught at a music camp right before September for a week. And then I did this Karen Davidson 9 in September, and then Myriad's going to Europe in October, and then Turboprop's going across Canada in November. It's too much. So I've learned already that this is too much. I can't do this again.
Right.
And I think it's just, you know, communication is really important, and just being aware.
Right. Have you been playing jazz music for your kids, like some of your favorite records and stuff like that? Is that something you're kind of trying to instill in them?
Yeah, we listen. I mean, we listen to a lot of different stuff in the car. I have a playlist that my son has kind of curated over the years, and it's to be honest, it's all over the map. There's like Kurt Rosenwinkel and Avishai Cohen, and then there's Bruno Mars, and then there's Stevie Wonder, and then there's Led Zeppelin. It's like, it's all over the place. So we're just showing them a lot of different stuff. And then, you know, and my daughter is the younger one. She's two, and she's hearing all of this stuff as well. So, you know, a Stevie Wonder song will come on, and within a bar, she knows what tune it is. It's kind of awesome. So, I mean, I as much as I want them to love jazz, I want them to love music first and foremost. And then, you know, whether they end up falling in love with jazz or classical or country or rock or, you know, or it's one of those things where I don't really necessarily want my kids to become musicians. Because I think it's the kind of thing where you need to really want it. And I don't know what they are yet. I have no idea what they're going to want yet. And I want them to figure that out.
Right.
But I want to give them appreciation for it. And I think they already have that. You know, they see me performing, and my wife is a teacher in the Toronto School Board, a music teacher in the Toronto School Board. So we're both doing music every day, all day. And they see that. And so they already know, you know, how important it is. And my son started taking piano lessons. So it's a thing, you know, it's something that we obviously value in the house. And I think as much as I want to, provide it for them in terms of like listening opportunities and everything else, I think I also want to let them just discover it and figure out what they like and what they love and what works for them.
For sure. Before we go, Ernesto, I want to get you to pick a track off of Abundance that we can play for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about that song in particular, I'd love to hear that.
I should have been prepared for that question. Because they all kind of have a little bit of an anecdote to them. But how about, because we talked about it, how about Song for Cito?
Sure.
Because you listen to it and just picture Joe Carter rounding the bases, jumping up and down.
Touch them all, Joe.
Exactly. You got it.
That flies by me as a baseball lover, so I'm happy to play that one. Ernesto Cervini's Turboprop new album is called Abundance. It is out on Anzic Records, and you can find it online and in stores. Ernesto, thanks very much for taking some time to talk, man.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was a pleasure.
I got a feeling I just can't shake. I'm not saying I'm a perfect man, but it's true I've done all that I can to keep you happy and satisfied and wash away all those tears you have cried. But I'm crazy, crazy, weren't good enough to keep you true when times were tough. Now I'm lonely and I'm awake, wondering how long I feel this heartache. Tried so hard to get it through to you, and all the while you treated me untrue. Don't know how much I can take. Oh, you, but I don't know.
Back here on Thank God It's Free Range, and just heard a pair of new releases from Coal Mine, the Cleveland Soul label, and that's C-O-L-E, not C-O-A-L. That was Junior Thomas and the Volcanoes with the lead-off track to their new album, Rockstone. What a shame. And before that, Happiness from Wesley Bright and the Honeytones. That is the B-side to a new 7-inch, some great reggae and soul and jazz on that label. And if you like that stuff, definitely check out Coal Mine on Instagram and Bandcamp and other places. Gonna get into a nice little set of sort of mellow music. Bad Bad Not Good have a new single out with Little Dragon called Tried. We're gonna hear that. We're gonna hear something from Munia. We've played Kisses Part 2, I think. Bizou Part 2, which is Kisses for You. We've got a new thing from her little EP, Del Mono, that's out on Luminel. And then Hearts, one of the newest signings to Arts and Crafts, has a new album coming out called New Compassion. We're going to hear a selection from that as well. Thanks for listening. This is Thank God It's Free Range.
Feels alive. like you've never been. I'm gone in the sky in the ways of the wind. No, it's nothing that I ever hold, but it keeps me going on. Passed by, saw your face in the clouds. Took a hardship stone to lift my heart from the ground. No, it's nothing that I ever know, but it keeps me holding on. Give me just a sign, heaven make it mine. God, I wanna fight. Give me just a sign.
Baby. she walks is overgrown, and I call out faithfully to my home, and the woods call back to me, where you gone? So